The following is a rebroadcast of Studio Tulsa. This program first aired last year.
Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Why do we behave the way we do? And how do we make decisions? And what shapes our beliefs? Most of us would like to believe it's through rational thought, our intellect, and our empathy and socialness towards others. But my guest today says we're governed by unconscious motives as much as conscious thought. Social and cognitive psychologist John Barge is one of the world's foremost researchers on how the unconscious mind influences our choices and behaviors. His new book, Before You Know It, The Unconscious Reasons We Do What We Do, draws on 3 decades of his research on the unconscious mind at Yale University, where he's a professor of psychology and the director of the ACME Laboratory, the Automaticity in Cognition, Motivation, and Evaluation. And yes, he did choose the name ACME based on the old Warner Brothers Roadrunner cartoons. His book is being hailed as one of the first comprehensive looks at the unconscious mind's influence on our decision-making in business, parenting, consumer behavior, gender, race, and personal relations. He joins us today to talk about his research here on Studio Tulsa. John Barge, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Very glad to be here, Rich.
You spent much of your professional life trying to understand how much our unconscious thought process affect our conscious decision-making and our attitudes. What interested you in this area of social science research?
You know, I just happened to be born at the right time, because this is a question, you know, many of us have. It's an existential question of how much control we have over our thoughts and feelings and behaviors. Back when I was in high school, a book by B.F. Skinner came out that was on cover of Time magazine. It was a shocking book called Beyond Freedom and Dignity. And he was a behaviorist who argued that we really didn't have any freedom at all, and free will didn't exist, and we were just under the control of the outside environment, like automatons, really. And so this was a hot topic back then, and we had a new sort of spirit and a new method in psychology when I was a psychology student in Illinois back then, which was the cognitive revolution, that we could actually start studying the workings of the mind and the conscious thought and other influences on thinking and behaving. And this was a brand new toy that we just started having. So I decided to look at this question sort of backwards, because the assumption at the time was that in that field is that everything we did, I think this is what we all feel anyway, right? That everything we do is under our conscious control, that we intend to do it, and also that we're aware of all the main influences on our decisions and our behavior, and we're sort of in control, like the captain of a ship. And that was what everybody said, and that's how we were taught, but no one ever had tested that. It was just a basic assumption. So I thought, okay, here's a potential avenue of research, because since it hasn't been tested, I'll just start testing it, and we'll just see how much we do that we need consciousness for and how much we don't need it for. And so by sort of a method of subtraction, I really wasn't interested so much in what the unconscious kinds of influences did as much as I was trying to see what exactly was conscious thought for, because it was then said to be for everything. And by subtracting out the things that it wasn't necessary for, you get a better idea of what it was necessary for. And the answer is not everything. We started out, taking little baby steps in the 80s and finding out that, you can form impressions and are influenced in your judgments of others without realizing it, factors you're not aware of, and that moved on to how you feel about things being good or bad, your attitudes, and that also didn't need your intention or awareness. It happened just spontaneously in your mind whenever you encountered anything, a box of Quaker oats or your mother. It doesn't matter. Every single thing turns into a good or bad reaction in your mind without intention. And we kept going from there, and we got into behaviors, the influences of the outside role in your behavior, sort of like what Skinner would have said, and then even goals and motivations, and just kept going. And it turns out that you really don't need consciousness and conscious intentions and awareness for most of the basic functions of the human mind. It's certainly there, and it's certainly very important, and it has a role, of course, and none of us would want to be without it. But that's sort of what my career has entailed since the 1970s, and the book summarizes a lot of that, but also what's really heartening is that we did a lot of this work with behavioral studies with people, undergraduates or people in different situations in our lab, and usually try to make them as realistic as possible, like making them understand what they were doing when they didn't even think they were in an experiment, sort of naturally. And what's been really heartening is that the recent advances in neuroscience imaging of the brain and other kinds of advanced techniques that we didn't have back then have largely confirmed the conclusions that we drew from all of that research. So what before you know it does is put all that together, you know, the very recent research as well as the older research, and showing that there's a real consistent pattern there about how the unconscious and conscious parts of your mind or functions of your mind operate together.
What are our unconscious thought processes? I assume it's not our autonomous brain functions, the ones that control respiration, you know, our basic functions of life. These are biases, perception tools that, like, if I'm driving home and I'm deep in thought, I know to stop at a stoplight. I'm not even thinking about stopping at the stoplight. My brain perceives the light turning red, I stop. Is it that sort of thing?
That's certainly a skill that you learn over time and gets practiced enough. Certainly, we all remember when we were 15 and 16 and starting to drive, and it wasn't like that then, right? When we were starting out, it was a total confusion of so many different things to do, and it was very hard. But with practice and a lot of experience, it became so routinized that you could do all these things without thinking. You can drive for 20 or 30 miles and have no memory of the highway, you know, often because you're so good at it. It becomes sublimated, goes down into your unconscious basically because of all the practice. And for a long time, people thought that was the only way that we developed any kind of unconscious process. It was a lot of experience and a lot of practice, like in driving or typing or anything else. And then the research started showing that even young children show these effects, some of them, and even infants show some of these effects. And this led to me having what I describe in the book as this epiphanal kind of dream involving an alligator, where I couldn't understand how, if these processes, as the field held, were all about, you know, a lot of experience and practice as in driving, how you could have infants and small children, young children, 3, 4, 5 years of age, also showing some of these effects. And what I realized was we actually come factory equipped with a lot of these. Through evolution, we have these kinds of things and tendencies already in birth, for example, to mimic each other, to prefer, and this is a little frightening, but even 3-month-olds prefer to look at people who are like them, the same race or the same ethnicity, than compared to other people. And that's only at 3 months. Not at birth, because they don't know yet who's similar to them, but until they have experience with their parents and siblings. But 3 months, they start already preferring to look at people who are like them. So these things are starting to happen very early in life, and the studies are showing that a lot of the effects we find in adolescents and adults are actually also found in children. That shows me that a lot of these things are there, you know, already through evolution, or some of them are innate tendencies, and then they persist throughout our adult life. But they affect things, for example, like your political attitudes. You know, they affect things like topics of today, like sexual harassment, racism. You know, studies have been able to show turn liberals into conservatives, and we have a study in there turning conservatives into liberals. And what are we doing? We're just basically playing with these deep roots of needs for physical safety and avoiding disease and things that are just basic human motivations, the most basic ones there are. But the roots of that tree spread up to the tallest branches and influence things like your political attitudes and your feelings towards other people, too.
Now, you have to tell us about how you turn conservatives into liberals only briefly.
No one has ever done this before, you know, but it has been done for many years. People have been able to change liberals into conservatives. And this is, of course, temporarily. We're not saying a permanent change. But liberals can start becoming more conservative in their attitudes, in their social attitudes and political attitudes, when they're threatened, when they are threatened in some way or feel afraid or some threat is raised. We all tend to become more conservative in our attitudes. And so that's been known for some time. But no one has ever turned conservatives into liberals. So what we did was just do the opposite of making people feel threatened. I had a wonderful graduate student who's now a professor at Stony Brook, Julie Wang, who came up with this genie idea, like a genie appears to you and grants you a superpower. And you have to imagine this richly, close your eyes, and just really imagine this happening. And the superpower is either to fly, that you can soar and fly like a bird, which is very pleasant. People like that one. That's a control condition. And the critical condition for us is imagining that you're immune from physical harm. You are totally physically safe, like Superman. Bullets would bounce off you. If you fell off a building, you'd bounce. Nothing would harm you. And you imagine that nothing harms you, and you feel this total physical safety. So we do that, and then we have them give their attitudes on standard issues that divide conservatives and liberals, like same-sex marriage or legalization of marijuana, you know, name it, those classic kinds of social issues where you get big differences. In the imagination to fly, like you have a superpower to fly condition, you get that basic difference. Conservatives are more conservative than liberals on those issues. No big deal there. But it goes away if they have imagined themselves to be physically safe. Now conservatives move down to have more liberal positions and are not that different from liberals. So these kinds of studies basically show, you know, the underlying motivation, which is the basic one we have to survive and to be safe, is sort of like the flame underneath a pot of boiling water. As it moves, as it gets stronger, if the fear or concern with physical safety, people become more conservative. If you turn down that flame by having people feel, at least temporarily, physically safe, then you actually turn their social political attitudes into more liberal ones.
Do you get the sense that any political forces are using this idea of fear as a motivating factor?
I think it's pretty obvious. You know, I think it's noticed by politicians. For example, our former President Obama has been speaking out about against the politics of fear. And we have the classic line from Franklin Roosevelt back in the 1930s, his first State of the Union address, where he said, "We have nothing to fear but fear itself." You know, a lot of us who grew up later think that's about World War II. We have nothing to fear but fear itself. We're going to war against the very strong enemies, and it was very scary. But he wasn't. That actually was a speech he gave in 1933 at the height of the Great Depression.
It's about the economy.
And he was trying to get people not to be afraid about the New Deal changes and social change that he thought were necessary.
Now, you've also done some other research on how people can become more favorable to immigration. And you found that this idea, and you go back through our history, there's lots of despicable rhetoric about equating immigration with disease and germs. You actually found that if you had a flu shot, you would express more positive reactions towards immigration.
Yeah, Rich, this is actually very similar to that physical safety idea. And it is true that very arch conservative leaders of the past have likened disliked social groups, you know, to bacteria or germs that need to be eradicated from the body politic, from the culture, and to be expelled or deported in the case of immigrants, or, you know, barriers put up for them not to be able to get in, sort of like as you shield yourself from germs getting into your body. And this metaphor is used by conservatives, maybe explicitly, maybe it's implicit, but it taps into this very powerful need that we all have to avoid disease and avoid germs entering our body. And this is, unfortunately, a very powerful metaphor that immigrants into your country are like germs getting into your body. And if you play into that metaphor, all of us feel like, no, we don't want that. You know, we, at very deep gut level, do not want to have germs invading our body and immigrants coming into our country if they're the same thing. And so that is, unfortunately, you know, equating human beings with germs and human beings with bacteria or viruses. But it's really there, and it's another example of how these very deep physical kinds of motivations for safety and so forth are underlying what we think are reasoned, abstract political attitudes. So the flu study, and this is very timely because, you know, right now it's October, and every October we get reminded to go get a flu shot, and that's going on right now. Back when that was going on a few years ago, the H1N1 virus was a very potent, dangerous flu virus back then. And so there was a lot of interest in getting people to take flu shots and to, you know, keep their hands clean with antibacterial wash and things like that. So what we did in the study was to remind people about the dangerous flu virus, raising that threat, and then we had them fill out attitudes about immigration, what their attitudes about, you know, immigration were. And then after that, we found out had they had the flu shot yet or not. We didn't know that beforehand. We didn't ask them beforehand, only afterwards. So for the people that we raised this threat of the flu, if they had the flu shot, their attitudes towards immigration actually became more positive because we had raised the threat, but they felt safe from it because they'd had the flu shot. For the other people who had not had the flu shot yet, we raised the threat. They knew that they weren't protected. They felt threatened. They felt physically unsafe, and their attitudes towards immigration became more negative.
Yeah, that's really amazing. You actually did another. There was another study which used hand sanitizer in the same way.
Mm-hmm.
And that the way, same results.
There's a way that you're supposed to do studies in that you don't want to have people self-select into different conditions because that's not random assignment. And People who have already gotten the flu virus could possibly be different people from people who had not bothered to get the flu virus yet. So we wanted to do an experimental manipulation where we just randomly assign people to either wash their hands with Purell after we raise the threat or not. And so we could randomly assign them to condition and control for that kind of individual difference thing we worried about in the other study, and we get the same effects.
My guest today is John Barge. He's a professor of psychology at Yale University and director of the Automaticity in Cognition, Motivation, and Evaluation Laboratory there. I love the acronym ACME.
Yeah.
And it was based on the old Roadrunner cartoons, was it not?
I'm a big Looney Tunes guy, I mean, from way back, and I love Roadrunner and Wile E. Coyote, and I always wanted to name my lab ACME, and so I just found an excuse to do it.
He's also the author of Before You Know It, The Unconscious Reasons We Do What We Do. He's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. I assume this idea of making people aware of the flu vaccine is an example of priming. You prime the subject, then you ask them about their positions and attitudes on immigration. Priming is a really major force on how it affects our behavior. How does it work?
Well, priming is really very simple. Primes are like reminders. You know, it's like if you have a note to yourself and you go on with your life and you see that sticky note on the door that says, pick up cat litter, right, or whatever it is, that reminds you, oh, and so what that note does is activated something in your mind, which is something that you want to do, and you may not have done it if you hadn't had that little reminder. And that's what primes do. Primes are outside of you, but they activate things in your mind that are inside your mind, which is interesting because it means that you can't be primed to do anything that you don't already want to do. It's got to already be in your head, otherwise there's no effect. So there's no worries about mind control here. But studies, for example, have primed the goals that people have outside in real life settings like grocery stores or butcher shops or restaurants or department stores and see what happens with their behavior. And so, for example, one Dutch study primed people their goal of dieting and eating healthy. And it was assumed that people who were overweight or obese would have this goal more than other people because they had a clear, you know, desire or need to lose weight or eat less or eat more healthily. And so the recipe flyers you know, sometimes get when you first walk into a grocery store contain those kinds of words in that condition, the diet and healthy eating, or they didn't in the control condition. And then people went and they did their shopping. And when they came out of the store, the researchers just looked at their receipts and they looked to see what they had bought. And if people who were overweight or obese had been primed with diet and health kinds of words in that flyer, they bought significantly less unhealthy snack foods, like one-third as much as the people in the control condition. And also, this effect didn't affect people who were not obese or overweight because they didn't have that goal. It wasn't in their head. So what primes do is generally activate things that are already in your mind, and then they have a more of an influence afterwards. But they're very natural occurrences in the outside world that we notice in our perception that trigger things that either our goals or our understandings or whatever, they have a greater influence there for a while. It doesn't last forever. These things usually go away in 3 to 5 minutes or something in the various studies. But we've been using that technique to do experiments to show that these effects happen without people being aware of the effect or intending them to happen.
And I assume advertising is a prime example of priming.
Yeah,
so to speak.
It's prime time. That's a great example of priming. And the word here is that, as we know, corporations have a lot more money than the usual university laboratory to do research, and they do their own research, and they know very well how these things work. So they actually are attempting to manipulate our consumer behavior often, even when we're home at the time watching the television. So, for example, we've done studies where we put food ads in a little comedy, five-minute comedy show clip in our lab and put a bowl of Goldfish crackers in front of people. They either saw the comedy clip with the food ad or not, a different kind of ad. And if there was a food ad of any type, they ate significantly more out of the bowl of Goldfish crackers. This is 8-year-olds as well as adults. And of course, had no clue that that's what affected them so strongly, seeing the food ads. It's like a what you see is what you do effect. But advertisers really know it. And unfortunately, this is a problem for things that we don't want our kids to be doing, for example, drinking. And a big study last year out of Northeastern University showed that over 1,000 preteens who were actually drinkers and they would have, like, on the average, well, at least one drink a month. And these are 13 to 19-year-olds. One alcoholic drink a month. The more television ads that had alcohol ads in them, like beer and Captain Morgan and any kind of alcohol, the more of those ads they saw, the more they drank that month. And these are effects that we think they're just ads. They don't affect our actual behavior, but they do. And so we need to be a little more careful, especially with our kids, you know, the kinds of ads that are on the programs that they're watching.
Now, a corollary to this idea that priming sort of makes us more likely to do something if we already have the idea in our head, you also write about desires and goals and how they can give unconscious thoughts more influence in our conscious decision-making.
Yeah, our goals are sort of running the show. You know, our current goal determines what we like and dislike. It says what's good and what's bad, and so we have to be careful what we wish for because those goals take over and run the show. So, for example, studies have shown college women generally don't think taking diet pills or using tanning salons is a very good idea. They both have serious health risks. And yet, in an experiment, this is University of Minnesota, they've just gone through a dating website like Tinder or something just to, in a study, like to rate how attractive the various people are on the website, and that's all they did. But it activates or triggers this idea of dating and mating and finding a partner. And for the goal, you know, to do that, you want to be attractive. And so with that goal operating, suddenly, through that goal-colored glasses, you know, tanning salons and diet pills are now a good thing. And so after that, they actually rated those things as not as bad as the other group did, and they also said they weren't as risky as the other group did. And so it's the goal that's changing what people think is good or bad and changing what is healthy or risky or not. And, you know, that's a real problem in the world with safe sex, you know, like, you know, taking risks and things when those strong goals are operating and thinking, you know, this is not as risky as it really is, or doing things you might normally not do and maybe you will regret later. And you have to be very careful about these motives and goals because they color the way you see the world.
Mm. So how much influence do unconscious thought processes have over our conscious decision-making?
Right.
Is it a matter of if we're really thinking this through, we're going to make the decision we want to make, or can they play a bigger role than we're aware of?
Well, for one thing, often when you're talking about things like preferences, like what you like, what kind of a food you like, or the kind of art you like, or these kinds of just preferences, the more you think about something, you can overthink and move yourself away from how you really feel. And studies have shown that the more time people are given to think about those kinds of choices, the worse choices they make, because they're not going with their natural feelings, and they're sort of overthinking it. So in those kind of situations, you know, you have to be careful. But here's one thing about before you know it, and I'm really not writing it. The book is not about judgment and decision-making because, per se, it's about everyday life. And the difference is when you're making a judgment or decision, you're already engaged in conscious, deliberate thought. You intend to make a decision. That's conscious intention. And that you are focused on information to make the best decision. So this is a domain of life that really is the specialty and domain of conscious thought already. And I'm sort of talking about all the things that happen when we're not deliberately, also at least, not deliberately trying to make a conscious thought. So, for example, we carry our work stress and our work kind of feelings home into our family life without realizing it. Or we, you know, have these political attitudes and feelings and emotional feelings about things, not realizing the underlying roots of it in our safety motivations and disease avoidance, those kinds of things. We don't realize how much we imitate other people when we're interacting with them and how they imitate naturally with us. And we don't realize the biases and things we have when people are not similar to us. All these things are operating not in the context of our sitting down and making a deliberate decision, because that's already the domain of a deliberate, intentional thought process. Even there, however, your feelings can color your deliberate conscious decisions in ways you may not realize. So, for example, if you do have some kind of negative cultural stereotype, and these things happen to people who are well-intentioned, who want to be egalitarian and fair, and yet our culture has seeped into our minds and given us these kinds of biases against minority groups in our society. And that's what the unfortunate studies have shown, that even well-intentioned people are prey to those cultural stereotypes. If you don't realize they're operating, you might have a negative feeling about somebody and think it's because of something they did. Mm-hmm. Or if you're looking at a job application, you might think it's because of their application. You know, their letters of recommendation aren't so good. You may not realize that the negative feelings are coming from these other sources, you know, that you learned as a child from the culture and they can still contaminate your deliberate conscious decisions. So it's really all aspects of life are prone to these kinds of influences.
And that's where you want to try to avoid using your gut intuition, I suppose.
Yes, you know, Rich, I'll tell you, there's one rule that about the gut. If you want to go with your gut, which is often great, especially when you see people in action, not faces or not, you know, if you see them in action, we're all pretty good at that, at judging people from just a little snippet, 15 seconds of seeing them in action. We're pretty good about that. But going with your gut, if you want to do that in your own life and make your own decisions, if it only affects you, that's your privilege. But, you know, when you're in a position where your gut feeling is going to affect the outcomes of somebody else, then you don't have so much of a right to go with your gut. And you do need to check your work, and you do need to make sure you're not being affected by these sort of natural things about that person's not similar to us or different group or these kinds of things, because even if you think you have good intentions, you still have the effect of that culture and what the culture has taught you as a young child, basically, about in-groups and out-groups and all of that. So if it affects somebody else besides you, you have more of a responsibility to check your work.
One last question that has to do with power of two little words that seem to have oversized influence on our decision-making and our perception, warm and cold. Why do these two words have so much influence?
This has been what I've spent a lot of my last 10 years researching, and we started out by asking exactly that question, because I see heating oil trucks go by and it says, "For our warm friends," on the back of the heating oil truck, you know, and so we all know this metaphor of warm and cold, and we use it just so easily. But why do we use these words warm and cold instead of friend or foe or, something like that? And, you know, this goes back through culture. I show how Dante, punished people who were cold in terms of betraying others by a level of hell where they're frozen in ice forever, the punishment that fits the crime. So this has been known to us, this relation between warmth and trust and coldness and betrayal or coldness and distrust. We've known this culturally and for a very long time. But only in the last 10 years have we actually studied it scientifically. And so in one of our first studies, we just had people briefly hold a warm coffee cup or an iced coffee cup, just incidentally, like, hold this for me while I get your papers. And they held it for a few seconds at most. And yet the people who held the warm cup formed a more positive liking impression of the person they read about than the people who held the iced coffee, even though they all read about the same person who was described identically. So what is this feeling of warmth? Well, it turns out they've talked about this with infants for a long time in terms of attachment and bonding with the parents. And the idea is that through breastfeeding and holding the baby close, the baby feels trust. They feel like, here's somebody who's taking care of me, who has my interest in heart, who will protect me from predators and nourish me and shelter me and all of that. And there's a very natural channel in us as infants and then throughout our life between feelings of physical warmth and feeling you can trust the person who's giving you that warmth. My wife used to work at a hospital, and she says nowadays they have the dad open up his shirt and the baby lays on the father's chest so that the father can also bond in this natural way with the baby. They talk about it as tactile, like skin on skin, but I think there's more than that. I think it's the warmth they feel. So it's a really natural channel that we've had for eons, thousands, millions of years maybe. And the neuroscience of the last 5 years has confirmed it, that the same little part of the brain in what's called the insula becomes active both when you hold something warm and when you are texting or talking to your family and friends. It is linked in our mind, and this is around the world, human nature. Our brains link physical warmth to the feeling of trust and social warmth.
The name of the book is Before You Know It. John Barge, thanks very much for joining us.
Rich, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
John Barge is a professor of psychology at Yale and director of the Automaticity in Cognition, Motivation, and Evaluation Laboratory there, known as ACME. And he's the author of Before You Know It, The Unconscious Reasons We Do What We Do. It's published by Touchstone. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.